meeting, the order, all of my members are here, but the representative act. And all of your members are here to represent. Senator Lass isn't here either.
I told him to get.
But you've got three members, that's all you need. Your senators, you only need three. Madam Chair, I didn't understand the other day because I was, as I said, I was ill. When you talked about the gavel changing, I thought you said that the gavel was going to change every meeting. You said it agreed.
It was my, I think it was my misunderstanding because I heard in the Senate caucus that we were going to do a 24-hour rotation. But then I found out later that the House hadn't agreed to that and we can just work it out.
We'll just change every meeting. So that's okay. We got that out of the way.
I think the thing we just didn't want to.
With that, then meeting adjourned.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Forgot I'm not chairing. You know, I think that it's a, we're both going to make a good faith effort to meet, to get our work done in a timely manner. And I think in the past, there were some chairs who would hold on to the gavel and never call a meeting. And that's just what we're trying to avoid. Of course, you and I aren't going to have that problem.
Of course not. Next on the agenda, I don't know, Madam Chair, how you would prefer to do this. If we want to just have a walkthrough announcement on this. Members in your packet last week, the other day, we were given the two spreadsheets, and I guess we've got an updated one that is more accurate with what is in. So if you guys want to toss what's in the packet, both this harder copy and the actual spreadsheet, you can just put it out for staff to discuss. There's an updated date on both of them of today's date, so those are the newer spreadsheets. I don't know. Are they available for the audience?
You so fit?
She's somewhere else.
Okay.
The end of the.
Okay, and with that, then, Madam Chair, if it's okay with you, we could just start since we have our side-by-sides now, we can just start walking through the bill.
Sounds good.
And then I may have a couple of proposals if we can get that far, but we'll see what happens.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you want to, as we walk through the bill, did you want to take questions from members?
I have no problem with that.
Mr. Chair, is it your desire to go through the riders as well as the language part, or do you want to just start with the language part?
Let's just go with the language first, and then we'll get through the riders afterwards.
I think that starts on R20. And I'll talk about the House provisions, and I believe Ms. Weidman will talk about the Senate provisions. On R20 on the House side, we have the House has a study directing the Office of Higher Education to review financial aid programs and to try to identify ways to promote certain occupations that are needed by the workforce through financial aid.
Mr. Chair, on the Senate side, we have more specific language about issues that the Office of Higher Ed should look into in terms of state grant study. And then if you go over to page R21, we also have some language that talks about loan repayment study, which is comparable to some of the language on the House side about addressing the needs of the workforce and so forth.
Mr. Chair, on 6.28 on the House side, we have a rider that requires a report by the Office of higher education. This is a report that's been required for the last several years. And the Senate has the same report, but it's a statutory, no, I'm in the wrong place.
You're right.
Yeah, well, not here. I am right, but not here.
Oh, okay.
My, do you want to talk about the Indian Scholarship?
The Indian Scholarship Program was a bill that Senator Olson had, and it is looking at transferring that program from the Department of Education to the Office of Higher Education.
And Mr. Chair, the House actually...
Excuse me. Go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to say a word about that. Is evidently, there's some of the tribes aren't real happy with the Department of Education. During the cut years, the Bemidji office was closed, and there were a lot of hard feelings about that. And they actually wanted to even relocate the office to Bemidji, but because some of the staff do multiple tasks, that didn't seem to be very realistic. And we would need the cooperation of kind of everybody to do something like that, or transfer it from Department of Ed over to Office of Higher Education. So,
Mr. Chairman,
so that's why we thought we'd have them take a look at it and study it and then come back with some proposal that everyone could agree with.
Mr. Chair, the House File 6, which is our education finance bill, actually transfers the American Indian Scholarship Program to the Office of Higher Education and transfers the appropriation and directs the reviser to recode the statutes dealing with that in the chapter that deals with the Office of Higher Education.
So we'll have to, Mr. Chairman, we'll have to see what they do and be sure we're kind of tracking.
We're supportive of that too, incidentally, and so I don't know how we approach that.
On page R22, starting on line 14.32, is the Senate language on non-resident tuition plans and eliminating undergraduate tuition rates that are different for non-residents and residents.
And Mr. Chair, the next two sections on the House and the Senate side are kind of our versions of the governor's Achieve programs. The House language provides an appropriation and establishes a pilot project for rural districts to provide rigorous education, including international baccalaureate and advanced placement programs, with a report.
On the Senate side, we basically are asking the Higher Education Advisory Council to do a study and look at the whole issue of using merit and need-based scholarships as a mechanism for increasing participation in rigorous courses. And then we list a number of different issues that we'd like them to look at in terms of issues that were brought up during discussions, such as access and, you know, what is available to different people, what kinds of students are participating in these programs, what would be the role of early intervention programs that would help parents and students prepare for college and make sure that students are taking the prerequisite classes early on so that they can take the rigorous courses in high school.
Madam Chair, Madam Senator Chair. Is there a financial part piece of your language here, or do you expect PIAC to do this? Is there a little appropriation part?
No, there's no appropriation because it's really very much consistent with the accountability work that they're doing and, you know, making sure students are prepared for higher education. So we thought that it was consistent with what they do.
Then continuing on R23, we have some language in there that Board of Trustees would look into rental programs and actually doing a study about rental programs, lease programs, and so forth relative to textbook rental. Starting on line 16.17 is additional textbook language study, asking them to look at educational strategies to reduce the cost of textbooks.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I think the textbook language is different in both bills, and there's different appropriations in both bills, so I'm not sure how you want to work. Would you be interested in, you know, setting up a work group or a couple members from each side that would work with staff and the students to, with some guidelines from us, to resolve this, or do you want to just discuss it with the whole group, the whole conference?
Well, you know, I think the students that were on are not, and this is the representative from old bill, if I'm not mistaken, so maybe a little input from them. And I think our pilot type project was a good approach, and we have $1 million for an actual pilot project in our bill.
Well, maybe when we get, maybe we could just set some time aside to hear from it, because it's more advanced than we are, and you know, I'm a big believer in you study, you pilot, and then you launch it so that we don't screw up, basically.
I just like the launch.
Yeah.
So.
I set that up for you. I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, on R23, the House has an appropriation to the Office of Higher Education for a grant to the Range Association of Municipalities to study student demand and employer need for higher education in the Mojave Range region. And the study is to be done through a contract and with the coordination and cooperation of the Board of Regents and the Board of Trustees.
On the Senate side, we have pretty much similar language, other than we don't have an appropriation to do the study, which the House includes.
On R24, Section 7, on the House side, this was a floor amendment on the House floor that encourages the Board of Regents and requires the Board of Trustees to not authorize funds that are appropriated by the legislature to make any modifications to its facilities or other accommodations for specific religious groups unless that particular system also makes an equal amount available to other religious groups to accommodate their practices. Section 8 is a legislative commission on post-secondary funding. It establishes a 12-member commission that is appointed by the Speaker and the Senate Committee on Rules, and they have to develop an alternative funding formula or method for post-secondary education. Considering both institutional aid and student aid, cost drivers in post-secondary education, federal funding, and a formula or method to consider the constraints on the state's budget. A report is expected of the commission, and it expires June 30th, 2008. On R25, Section 9 is Representative Kahn's bill. It's the University of Minnesota Minneapolis Area Neighborhood Alliance. It's a group that grows out of a report that was done on the Minnesota Minneapolis Area Neighborhood Impact Report, and the House provides some funding for this initiative. The Alliance is supposed to cooperate with the city and the university and the neighborhoods to do projects that are relevant to the area.
We have it in there. I think we have this in our agenda.
On that subject, do you have any idea what's going to happen on that one time?
We're not going to get any one-time money.
That's a really negative attitude. We've got the one-time money, so.
Well, we have to get it together.
Yeah, I hope we can. Okay, sorry.
I hope we can get more permanent money.
Mr. Chair, on R26, Section 1 in the House and Section 1 in the Senate are identical. They're a technical change. Section 2 in the House is a construction management education surcharge and account. It puts a quarter of a mil surcharge on non-residential construction permits to fund a construction management education program through the Office of Higher Education.
Seems to me we talk to these people. Does anybody on my staff remember? Yeah, did we have a meeting with them? Must have been me by myself. Yeah. Shortage of construction managers,
right,
or something?
I'm sure this is Representative Mike Nelson's bill, and the building contractors are very supportive of this. This is their proposal. They've got a fee set up, as you can see, of 1/4 mil or 25 cents on the actual fee, that's construction fee that's paid to whoever, local entity or whatever they pay it to. They are very supportive of this because they are having a hard time finding trained people to run these construction sites. So I haven't heard of any opposition of it. We had some opposition or questions by the Republican caucus in the House, but other than that, no one's come forward opposing it that I know of.
Mr. Chair, could we get clarification on non-residential? Would that include, Madam Chair, would that include school buildings and municipal buildings that are built also, so we'd have a surcharge?
Those would be included. Mm-hmm. It would just be the home. And I don't know if maybe, Council, you can help me. Is there a limit on, like, apartments, fourplexes being considered residential? Or?
Mr. Chair, the provision doesn't distinguish between multifamily residential and single-family residential. So I would say it's probably not on cluster residential.
Is that the
yes.
answer your question?
Yes. Mr. Chair.
I'm wondering if it's been indicated that there's actually not enough training programs or just not enough students going into these areas of education, because there's quite a difference there. I don't know if there was short on the number of programs available, or we're not for some reason enticing students to take this as a major, construction management.
I think it's a little bit of both, but it may be more of the latter. I can't remember. I should know who the lobbyist is. I can see his face, but right now his name is slipping me. But they said they just can't, as people retire, as baby boomers are retiring that have been running their construction sites for years, there's nobody coming up to take their place. And I think it's more, it's not just that the programs aren't being offered at campuses, it's also that nobody's going into it. But I think it would be a specific thing. Yeah, Gary Davis. A specific program that they're going to help develop. So.
Mr. Chair.
It's not a significant amount of money on that. We had the question in Finance Committee, and we screwed up the answer. And somebody asked on like a $40 million. A $60 million building project, it would be 15 grand. That's how much would go into this fund. At this, 25 mils or 25 cents, whichever is bigger.
Mr. Chair, how much would it be expected to raise annually?
$1,030,000. We put it in this fee account, and then it's...
Mr. Chair, we have a program that's on R43.
Okay. Any other questions, Doc? Senator Sharon, did you have a question?
Yes, I had a similar question. I know I'm trying to pull through the web up here. There is a construction management, or there was one at Minnesota State Mankato, and I don't know. I can't remember. I know that when they're taking a look at the reduction of students in certain programming, that it may mean that it's a program that they
would have reduced or eliminated if there wasn't enough interest in the program, or it may still be operating there. So I am curious about this.
We'll have Mr. Caden come in as we move farther along and see if you can get a hold of Representative Nelson and Gary Caden and have them come in and, and talk about the lead question. Okay.
Mr. Chair, on page R27, the House adds a member, a representative of the Minnesota Private Colleges Council to the existing Minnesota Agriculture Education Leadership Council. And on page R28, the House has several sections that deal with high school students being ready for college, and this is one of them. It encourages or it requires the MNSCU working with the Department of Education to establish a passing score for the mathematics test that students take to indicate that those students who pass the mathematics test are ready for college. On page R29, it also does the same thing for the existing language arts tests that are taken in high school. And on R29, going over to R30, it directs the Commissioner of Education to collaborate with MNSCU to develop a plan to communicate with Minnesota high school students beginning in the ninth grade what the state's expectations are for college readiness.
Excuse me. Yeah. On the earlier provisions regarding the high school testing, my understanding is these provisions are also in the E-12 bill, but with a different, more direction for authority to the Office of Educational Accountability. So there may be some discussion across those bills on these provisions.
Members, you know, with this, we were trying to deal with the whole issue of, you know, remedial training and missing students in high school, and we had some language in our bill originally that I can't remember if it was in Representative Murphy's committee. Some of the K-12 members liked what we had in the bill, but they wanted it fixed up a little bit, and it's probably the same language that they put in that bill. And this basically came in collaboration with members of the K-12 committee. I think it's good language and it doesn't cost any money, and we're doing this now, so why don't we do it so that we can hopefully save money when students get into the post-secondary system. Senator.
Mr. Chairman, there is a P-16 group, and so I just don't know if they've looked at this language and if that's kind of consistent with what they're working on. Maybe Ms. Hegard could help us find out from Ms. Chris.
Ms. Hegard, do you want to come up or tell us you support this in the Senate? Senators to make a motion to accept it. Move on from there.
Mr. Chair, members, I just got here, so I was just looking at the language. Is it 2821 through 2826 or 2825?
Yes, and then on the next page too. 29.6 to 11.
It would seem to me, Mr. Chair, that this ought to be a discussion item for the P-16 Council. I mean, I would be happy to, when I go back, put this, you know, to put an email out and talk about this as an agenda item, even for there's a June meeting coming up. But I haven't talked with Commissioner Segrin about this. I haven't talked with Chancellor McCormick about this. It does seem to me, though, that it's something that deserves some discussion among folks in that group before it's implemented.
Well, maybe you can get an opinion from them within the next couple of days instead of June. We're not in June anymore, and then, you know.
Mr. Chair, no. Yeah, my point was I could send an email out, get a quick response, and then this could be put on the agenda also for June. So I'd be happy to do that.
Well, I won't
get you an answer.
Yeah, after we pass it, then you want to put it on your agenda, is that what you think?
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Yeah. Oh.
But I'll go back to my office, Mr. Chair. I will send an email out to the Chancellor, to President Brunix, to Alice Segrin, just asking for some input on this to
okay,
see.
Okay, that would be nice.
Okay.
On page R30, on the Senate side, starting on 17.22, is some reworking of the funding policy language. And starting on 17.32, this is language that previously appeared in 135.8.053 and was just moved. And continuing on page R31 at the top on the Senate side, again, is additional language that talks about the replacement for the funding formula and identifies the sources that are used to determine the appropriations for the U and MinSCU. And then continuing on in section 5, again, continues some of the funding language. And then starting on line 18.33 and continuing on to page R32 is basically the various reports that MinSCU and the university submit to the legislature. These are previously included in the laws and have been submitted by both systems, and this just codifies that.
Mr. Chair, on R31 on the House side, the House requires to make some changes to an existing report that requires the public post-secondary systems to report to the Minnesota Office of Higher Education and the Department of Finance, offering some input by the Office of Higher Education.
On page R32, section 8, asks both the U and MinSCU to prepare their budget priorities in accordance with the statewide objectives for higher education.
Mr. Chair, on page R32 and continuing to R33, section 7 of the House provides a statutory definition for resident tuition that allows students who have attended high school in Minnesota for 3 or more years, graduated from a state high school, or achieved a GED, and are registered as entering students at a public institution of higher education to receive resident tuition. It also requires any individual who is not a citizen but meets these requirements to apply, to fill out an affidavit that they will become permanent residents when they have the opportunity to do so.
The Senate language on that provision is comparable to the House language, except that on starting on line 20.23 to 20.28, the Senate adds the additional language that addresses student financial aid and allowing these students to receive financial aid that is from private sources.
On R33, section 8 of the House, this was an amendment added on the House floor that prohibits the use of state appropriations to MinSCU or the University of Minnesota to be used directly or indirectly to the early termination of a contract in the athletic departments on any campus. Section 9 deletes some obsolete language, I believe. This was recommended by the Office of Higher Education. It's replaced by some other reporting requirements. And on R34, section 10, this is the final piece of our college readiness provisions that we talked about earlier, and this requires MinSCU to collaborate again with the Commissioner of Education in developing passing scores and to develop and implement a statewide plan to let all Minnesota high school students to know what the state's expectations are for college readiness. In addition, that MinSCU must provide its prospective students with information that indicates the level of academic preparation that's necessary for college.
On the Senate side, starting on 20.32, this is a bill that Senator Dill had introduced and basically requires Minsku and asks that the University of Minnesota provide students information on personal financial management and says that students that enroll in a college course providing similar instruction would be not have to receive the information. And then continuing on Section 9 on the Senate, no, Section 11 in the House is a technical correction. That's the same on both sides. On the Senate side, on R35, starting on 20.25, is Senator Pappas's bill prohibiting the selling of marketing of credit cards and also selling student information.
Mr. Chair, on R35, Section 12 of the House adds that a person who receives a railroad retirement annuity at the age of 60 years is eligible to take classes as a senior citizen at the University of Minnesota. Section 11 of the Senate and Section 13 of the House are identical clarifying language for the senior citizen tuition programs, and Section 12 and 14 are also identical clarifying provisions for the senior citizen education programs.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The railroad retirement, retired railroad person, that wasn't part of the other language from the Minsky language. Did that come in as a separate bill?
I think that may have been in our bill that came off the...
And it wasn't Maddie Ryder?
A committee. No, we just added it to the senior citizen.
But it was, somebody had a bill to do that?
I don't know if we just had it as an amendment, or when we put the bill together. The railroad folks, a lot of them retire and reach that retirement age earlier, and so it was requested that we put it in.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Chair.
You know, I can see it as a bit of a slippery slope because we have a lot of public employees who retire early, and we have a lot, you know, like police officers and firemen and even teachers. And I don't know what this means, moving it from 62 to 60. That to how much of a break do senior citizens get, and what does this mean financially to institutions that have to consider a lower retirement age?
If you want, we can fix this up by saying 55 to legislate.
Mr. Chair, that wasn't what I was thinking. It would be a nice perk, but I mean, once we give it to one group, I don't know how we deny giving it to other groups that might have early retirement too. So I do have some concern about that.
Mr. Chair, at the bottom of R36, Section 13 of the Senate and Section 15 of the House are identical. They make some changes to the definition section of the Office of Higher Education. Section 14 in the Senate and R37 and Section 16 in the House are essentially identical. The House adds the GI Bill to the same section of law in a different section of this bill. And they're technical, they tend to be technical changes. And Section 16 of the Senate and Section 18 of the House are also identical technical changes, as are the changes in Section 17 and 19 and 18 and 20. But Sections 18 and 20 make some changes to the definition of eligible institutions for the state grant program, and Section 17 adds identical reporting requirements for the Office of Higher Education.
Just going back to R37, there's one little small item in there on 23.27 on the Senate side. Section 15 on the Senate side, Section 17 on the House. This is language dealing with the expiration of the Student Advisory Committee for the Office of Higher Education. The Senate extends it to 2009, and the House has a language that does not expire. Then on page R39, on the Senate side, we have the cost of attendance being going from average to actual tuition and fees.
Mr. Chair, on the bottom, the next few sections all are deal with appropriations. The House and the Senate have changed the state grant program within the amount of appropriations. On the bottom of R38, the Senate changes the assigned family responsibility. The House on page R39 changes the student share by reducing it a half percentage point. And as Ms. Weidman said, the Senate on R39 changes the tuition to actual tuition.
Then at the top of page R40, this is an issue that we've been discussing for a number of years, and that is how to use the surplus in the state grant program in the second year of the biennium. The Senate extends that provision through for another 2 years.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, it's we worked on this a couple years ago, but it's really important that we have a mechanism to deal with the surplus. Otherwise, it goes back to the general fund. And I think this has worked out well, but finance is still a little uneasy with it, and they reluctantly agreed to extend the sunset for 2 years.
Mr. Chair, on the bottom of R40 is the place where the Senate provides a statutory report on state grant spending, and the House has it as a rider, but the language is essentially identical. In R41, Section 23 in the Senate and Section 22 in the House are identical provisions, and they deal with eligibility for grants for people who have been in the military serving on active duty.
Section 24 on the Senate side is the increase in the child care grant that an individual is eligible for from $2,300 to $2,600.
On page R42 on the House side is the teacher program, which provides scholarships and educational incentives for early childhood teachers and for retention of people in the early childhood profession. And it's administered through a nonprofit organization. It provides scholarships of up to $5,000 per year for courses that lead to credentialing or a degree, and incentives of $100 to participants. It can also be used by the nonprofit for retention incentives for people who are working in the child care field. And there is an advisory committee that works with that. Section 24 on page R43 is the construction management program that's funded with the surcharge on non-residential building permits. It's administered by the Office of Higher Education. There's an advisory committee that consists of construction management people, including the mechanical contractors, the electrical contractors, general contractors, and other named groups. It provides grants from the account that was established earlier, and they can be used for programs that rescue institutions to maintain or upgrade facilities, to provide greater access to modern construction standards and management practices, to achieve accreditation, and to promote closer ties between technical and community college and four-year construction management programs, and to support the development of new programs. And there is a listing of grants that are awarded based on the type of programs that the institution has and the number of graduates. There's a report required to the legislature, and the information in the report is specified. It also permits the Office of Higher Education to use up to $15,000 per year for the administration costs. Sections 25 of both.
Senator Roblin, did you have any more questions on that? Question. I see there, if you look on subdivision 2 grants, that they're used to maintain and increase the quality and availability. Or was it Senator Sharon that asked?
I did.
So it looks like it augments what's there and I think get more people in the field at the same time.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The one concern I have is that when these people do get these jobs, they're usually very high-paying jobs. And I often think that salaries entice people into professions, and if people know that there's openings in high-salary areas, that they are more likely to pursue them, without incentives. I can understand more of the child care one that you have, because those are not high-salary positions, and giving them grants for educational advancement is something we might have to encourage because of the cost of the education is not always quickly repaid by the salary once the job is received. But I will need some more explanation about this because I do think these are really good paying jobs. And if maybe a loan program would be more appropriate than outright grants for some of these students too, because they should be able to repay them.
The grants, Senator, are going to the state colleges and universities themselves to support the construction management education and to promote outreach, et cetera. But there's a shortage from what we've been told by Mr. Eden. There's a shortage, and I mean the university and the Minsku system are asking us for money for science, technology, engineering, and math because people aren't going into that. Engineers obviously make a lot of money using your theory, but there's a shortage. So I think the same thing is happening in this field. But we'll get Mr. Seaton in here and talk to you. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, on R45, Section 25, of both bills are identical and technical changes. Section 26 of both bills are identical and deal with a change in the definition of eligible institution for the loan program at the Office of Higher Education.
On the Senate side, sections 27 through 32 are just technical changes that go along with the changes in the career school and private school regulation.
Mr. Chair, we don't. The House does not have those sections because we didn't repeal 136A.1702. We didn't repeal that in the Senate.
Then on page R46, section 33 of the Senate language authorizes the Office of Higher Education to do interest swaps so that they can get better rates for student loans.
Mr. Chair, the House directs the Office of Higher Education to develop a plan for implementing interest rate exchange and swaps or other protection agreements and to report back to the legislature by January 15th of 2008.
On page R47, on the Senate side, sections 34 through 37 are technical changes. And then on R48, the language in both the Senate and House are the same, and this allows institutions to award an additional term of work study payments to students that are enrolled half time or less.
On page R49, section 39 of the Senate and section 28 of the House are identical. It increases the revenue bond limit at the Office of Higher Education.
And sections 40 to 43 are the same in both the House and Senate, and these are the changes in the ICAP program. And then going to R51, on the Senate side, section 44 changes the membership of the Minsky Board, increases it from 15 to 16, and adds the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development as an ex officio member, non-voting member. And then there's further language starting on 33.30 that directs the governor to consider various needs of the board in terms of labor and business, and also in terms of representation on the basis of racial, gender, and ethnic composition.
Mr. Chair, the House in Section 33 increases the size of the Minsky Board to 17 members and directs two members must be members of the AFL-CIO.
The language in Section 45 of the Senate just makes some technical changes to be consistent with the membership changes that are made in Section 44. And then on the Senate side, at the top, R52, Section 46 asks the Trustee Advisory Council to look at various issues and criteria in terms of looking at potential members. This includes diversity in terms of geography, gender, race, occupation, and I think some of these things they already do within their policy, but this codifies that.
Mr. Chair, on page R52, section 34, the House provides a selection process for appointing the members of the AFL-CIO to the Board of Trustees. And sections 47 of the Senate and section 35 of the House are identical and delete not the lead report. Beginning on the bottom of page R52, is the textbook pricing and access program for the both the House and the Senate.
Section 48 are various provisions that are recommendations from the textbook advisory task force. The Senate doesn't go quite as far as the House did in terms of what they're doing in terms of changing activity regarding textbooks. On page R53, the Senate, starting on 35.9, asks instructors to look at ways to simplify and make more cost-efficient the textbooks that they buy, and also asks bookstores to get more reasonable rates from publishers.
Mr. Chair, the House's textbook language is more regulatory than the Senate's. It provides a purpose, which is to improve student access to textbooks at a reasonable price. It provides definitions of the terms that are used in the book. It requires publishers to disclose a variety of information that's listed there, with a few exceptions. It requires the publishers to disclose the information on their websites or in its marketing material, or when a request is made, a written request is made, and provides an exception for certain mass marketed and trade books. It requires each post-secondary institution to adopt policies that allow students to include the price of course material purchased at bookstores in their tuition plans, tuition payment plans, and it has instructions to those people who purchase textbooks or specify which textbooks are going to be purchased and when they have to notify the bookstore and how the bookstore must notify the student with information on the textbook. It requires the Office of Higher Education to develop some strategies for improving textbook purchases and to maintain request forms that can be used to get information from publishers on their website.
On page R56, section 49 of the Senate side codifies the provision about not charging differential tuition for residents and non-residents. And on line 36.8, it says that the subdivision does not apply to tuition rates for a resident of the state that has entered into a reciprocity agreement.
Sections 50 of the Senate and section 36 of the House are identical, and delete some obsolete language from the new statutes. Section 51 of the Senate and section 37 of the House are also identical and deal with the banking services for new section on page R57, section 52 of the Senate and section 38 of the House are identical and increase the state matching grant for the college savings program.
On the Senate side, sections 53 and 54 deal with the regent selection process. Section 53 has the RCAC submit their recommendations to the joint committee as well as to the governor. And in section 54, it reconfigures the members of the joint committee and says that the joint legislative committee consists of the members of the higher education budget divisions in each house of the legislature. And then in clause B, it again asks that the joint committee consider not just the names forwarded by the governor, but also all of the RCAC recommendations.
And Mr. Chair, on R57, the repealer that the House has is printed there. On the House repeals all of the statutory language on the Regent Advisory Council and the Regent's election process.
I tried to fix it.
It needs fixing, but not
on page R58, on the Senate side, this basically prohibits the assessment of late fees when the payment of educational benefits for veterans are delayed at either the state or federal level. It adds the state language, state payments, to the existing language.
Mr. Chair, on page R58 is the start of the House's GI Bill for veterans. The first section here we talked about earlier, we add the responsibility for the GI Bill to the Office of Higher Education. The provisions for the GI Bill are similar in both the House and the Senate with a few policy differences. And it may be easier to discuss them rather than going section by section, but we have a table that summarizes the policy differences. Mr. Chair, the House and Senate GI bills are pages R58 to R63. And as I said, they are very similar. There is a difference in eligibility. The Senate requires veterans to serve 90 days or more in a foreign country during declared hostilities to be eligible for the benefits, and the House does not have a comparable requirement. There is a difference in residency requirement. The Senate requires eligible people to be a resident of Minnesota within 6 months of initial enlistment or re-enlistment, and the House requires Minnesota residency at the time of enlistment or reenlistment. Slight difference. Both the House and the Senate provide for a prorated grant, half of the full-time grant for students who are part-time. The House defines what part-time is. And in calculating the grants, the Senate subtracts the National Guard tuition reimbursement benefit along with the Pell Grant and the state grant from the grant award. The House subtracts the Pell Grant and the state grant, but does not subtract the National Guard benefits. And then there are differences in the maximum grant awards. The Senate has $1,000 per term for full-time students, and the House has $1,250 per term for full-time students. They both have half of that for part-time students. The Senate provides a maximum of $3,000 for, this is printed wrong. It's $3,000 per state fiscal year. And the House has $3,570 per state fiscal year.
For part-time.
No, I'm sorry, that was a typo. It's per state fiscal year for anybody. No, just on the three, it should be $3,000 maximum per state fiscal year for a recipient for the Senate, and it should be $3,570 per state fiscal year under the House provision.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Ms. Novak, I'm looking at the line that says part-time, so I assume that's still there. It's still part-time, for part-time students.
No,
for
anybody. You should delete
if you're
going to do this as
an
amendment.
I see, part-time is $500 per term,
$3,000
per year. I got it.
And $10,000 lifetime total for both the House and the Senate. Those are essentially the policy differences between the two provisions. As I understand it, Mr. Chair, the House bill actually has a typo in it, and it should be $3,750 per state fiscal year. So it is the bill that has the typo.
Typically, if they did a four-year degree, they get done in 4 years. Because by giving them the higher amount, it would use the $10,000 up in 4 years. I think ours is a little different, partly because a lot of times we have students who don't complete in 4 years. We'd like them to, but they don't. And then they use up their money before completion.
You know, we had a lot of negotiations going on between Representative Leader, who was carrying the Attorney General's bill, and Representative Hawes, who was carrying the Governor's bill. And so these numbers were kind of changing daily at the end. So the logic behind it, I would have to bring Representative Hawes here to explain where they ended up at that 3750, unless staff or something. But we weren't really involved in that process. It was more of a negotiation process between the two representatives and people from the governor's office and the attorney general's office. So. But you bring up a good point.
Mr. Chair, the House on page R63 requires the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs in consultation with the Office of Higher Education to review participation in the GI Bill and to make recommendations on to readjust the benefit levels and program funding. And on page R63, section 39, gives authority to the Board of Trustees.
Oh, wait, before we go on, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
I don't know, maybe these are the same in both bills. Did you front load your money so that it could be used in the first year? So that is another then difference. Mm-hmm. We front loaded it.
Section 39 gives authority to the Board of Trustees to enter into a 40-year lease agreement to build a YMCA at Minnesota West Community and Technical College. And Section 57 in the Senate and Section 41 in the House are repealers. There are some differences in the repealers. We talked about the House repeals the Regent Advisory Council and the process for selecting regents. The House does not repeal 136A1702, which is reporting to the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Otherwise, and the House repeals the old remaining process for funding higher education in Chapter 135A.
And on the Senate side, the various repealers deal with sort of the recodification and repealing of various funding formula language and accountability reporting language. And I think, as Ms. Novak mentioned, the Senate repeals the language in 136A.1702 that makes the Office of Higher Education go to the Legislative Audit Commission for the work they do in terms of the sophomore program.
Mr. Chair, Article 3 in the Senate and Article 5 in the House is a reworking of the regulations on registering and licensing private institutions by the Office of Higher Education. Both the Senate and the House attempted to put into law an agreement, a somewhat evolving agreement, between the parties and how the regulation should occur. So, and it has been evolving even over the last couple of days.
So we don't
couple hours. There wasn't an agreement to them.
I thought there was an agreement.
And we do have, Mr. Chair, we do have an amendment that we think is fairly close to the final agreement, but the people who are parties to the agreement would have to tell us
that. Madam Chair, I thought maybe we could get rid of, get this out of the way, at least Article 5, because we thought it wasn't controversial, but now maybe everybody's on the same page. We can offer it. So, Ms. Hegard, do you want to come up and tell us if everybody's on the same page? Or?
Yeah, I would like to hear from everyone.
And the private sense.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Pappas, I'm not going to testify. Mr. Mishkanis has been the one really working on this compromise, and I believe we are done evolving now. So he's been working closely with the private college council and then with the for-profit institutions.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Mark Mishkanis with the Office of Higher Education. I think we're there. I guess I've not seen a draft of the most recent amendment. But there were discussions on three remaining issues, I think, during the course of the day and through conversations with both the career schools and the a private college counsel. I think there was some agreement. But I would like to see the final amendment before we... But other than that, Mr. Chair, I did see a copy of an earlier amendment, and it did have, I think, all included all the changes, some corrections that we had found along the way. It had merged some language from a bill that Senator Pappas had heard in her committee at one point on some changes, and included some of the other things that were of interest to the parties along the way. So,
can we give Mr. Miskonis a copy?
And if you got an extra for Mr. Morris over there, to Jim, because he just gave his.
Mr. Chairman,
Go ahead.
Maybe we have other things that we can probably talk about.
We can just let them look at it.
And
keep going, and they can look at this. Yeah. And then if everybody's in agreement, we can at least get this out of the line.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So.
Mr. Chairman, I did review it earlier, and there's a, I mean, it looks like it represents what we thought the deal was, what you thought the deal was, but I haven't reviewed the language, and there's a couple of things in there, and I would suggest, I mean, that you give them overnight, I think it'll be all right, and we can clean up the language, and it won't be a big deal.
That would be fine. That's a good suggestion. So you guys don't have to rush. Mr. Miskonis, we'll let everybody look at it overnight, and then we'll, the next time we meet, we'll, next Monday, we'll. Okay. Go ahead then.
Mr. Chair, I believe that finishes, unless you want to go through the private college registration language section by section.
Okay. Any. Do you have a list for us? Or? You worked with
yes,
we both worked on these together. Are there any questions on the bill itself for the members before we go to the similarities in the bill that maybe we can get out of the way here today? Any questions at all for the members? Okay, who's Ms. Novak or Ms. Lehner, are you going to take this? Who wants to take it?
Mr. Chair, I believe we pointed out as we went through most of these, but we can start with the same provision. On R26.
Yeah. I don't know. Unless any members have any concerns, we're basically adopting what is either almost exactly identical. Is this all exactly identical?
Mr. Chair, the top of the page has things that are identical.
Okay. Well, Senator Pappas, then I just move at least the lines that say same from R26 through 57.
Mr. Chairman, since you're chairing, maybe I'll move it.
You go ahead and do what you want. You're the senator, and we're in your. Go ahead.
I'll just move that that the conference committee adopts all the same provisions into the conference committee report.
You've heard the motion. Are there any questions on the motion? Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Senator,
is that in the entire conference committee report or just the limited portion that you were looking at, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
in the spreadsheet is the entire, well, the comparison between the Senate and the House bill. So, are you talking about this part of the stuff that I haven't?
No. I know you've always got a pocket, honey.
Well, no, so it's just
the top of the page.
Just the top of the page. All right.
Same, just the same.
Okay, no further questions then for my new members. We do need 3 votes, so I actually we've got 3. Any questions? Not all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, that motion prevails. And then maybe just on the similar, if there's anything to worry about on the, and I'm looking at particularly the Mesaba Range one, and I think Minskew wanted a neutral party. The Range Association did a similar study years ago, and so.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
On that Mesaba Range higher education needs assessment, since the House has money and the Senate does not, I would like to leave that for now and consider that in the mix with the money bills.
That's fine. And is there, what are the other, because that is a significant difference as far as I'm concerned on that one. So I'm wondering, Ms. Novak, if you want to just zip through these.
Well, Mr. Chair, on page R21, 14.8 on the Senate to 14.15 is essentially the same as the House's. I could take either one of those. It's just a format difference.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. So the question is whether we want it in the rider or in the statute. And in the rider, it's more in session laws.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, both of these are uncoded language. It's just a style difference, and it doesn't matter really.
Well, I like your style more than my own, so Senator, so we can accept you. We can accept your language there. You want to take these individually?
Sure.
So if you want to move the Senate R21.
I'll move the Senate language.
14.8 to 14.8.
On R21, Section 8.
Yeah. Is there any questions on that from any members? Senator Sherman, did you have a question?
I had a question.
Okay. Anybody over here? No? All right. You heard the.
Just one. Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
Are you going to like keep track of how many Senate provisions and
of
how many House
provisions?
Of
course I am. That's why I'm trying to move quickly.
That's why you're trying to get me to do the easy ones on the Senate side.
Because I'll keep reminding you of that.
Yeah, so that's already done. Okay, I get it. Just want to make sure I knew.
I already accepted one of your amendments, all the same ones.
All the same.
Yeah. You're already one of them.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Now you're 2 up.
That was superior language.
I knew he was trying to stick her.
But the Senate had superior language in this one.
And
I'm glad you recognized that.
Senator, I did not say that senators let me clarify what I said. I said I liked her style better than mine, is what I said. I was referring to more of a personal thing than language.
Hence my clarification.
Go ahead.
We discussed the similar provision on R23, the Mesabi Range Higher Education Needs Assessment.
We're going to hold that one
right.
Aside.
Well, I thought since I've given you 2, I could. But go ahead.
The next one.
Mr. Chair, and next on R32 and R33 are the provision on resident tuition and private eligibility. The provisions are identical except for the House, the Senate adds an additional subdivision on scholarship and financial aid.
I think, you know, we know that there's somebody, I think there's a lot of support at the table for this, but there might be somebody that doesn't support this and might want to weigh in. So why don't we maybe move by this for now?
Ms. Novak, did you pass the one in R20 on purpose? Because it's more complicated?
It, Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas on R20, they're both studies of financial aid. They're similar in purpose, but there are significant differences between them.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
On this financial aid study, could we just ask the staff to just get together and maybe merge the language? I don't know if there's, the Senate is a little bit more extensive than the House and what we're asking the Office of Higher Education to do. I don't know that I've heard from the Office of Higher Education that they have any issue with our language. They might want to be involved in that discussion.
Madam Chair, if you're open, Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, if you're open, our office, our staff would be very happy to be part of those meetings as you're working through the language.
Was Representative Martin, was this language yours on our side? I can't remember. Would you like to come up and comment on it, maybe? Since the Senate's more extensive. Go ahead. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I certainly think there's compromise here. I just, the focus and the intent was to look at the needs of the state in the long run as the baby boom generation approaches. What would be our best investment in the area of supporting our students in higher education? And so the language was drafted to try to get our hands around that as well as support the bill that we heard at our committee about dealing with speech pathologists. That's why that is specifically mentioned in there, because that was one of the areas that we're having a hard time filling currently. And this research was to see if we can't continue to look at that position and others and support them in the future with dedicated or targeted funding.
And Ms. Hegar, did you say you had a preference, or you just wish to work with staff on it?
Mr. Chair, I think if the staff is going to get together to work out differences, we'd be very appreciative, at least to have Mr. Canis involved in the discussions, if that's possible, just to make sure that we're understanding what's being expected of us.
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I understand, and certainly workforce needs is one thing, but as I look at our language, we really wanted them to take I don't know that we've ever looked at our financial aid program very thoroughly. It's meeting the needs of students in our state. Even I think we might even have some consideration, or maybe that's language somewhere else, in terms of graduate education. Now, in many professions, it's really important that you have a graduate degree, and our financial aid program only goes through the undergraduate degree. And part-time students is another issue. We have more and more students that are going part-time. Independent students, where parents aren't contributing to their cost of their education. So I think there's really a lot of things that we need to look at with the state grant program.
Okay. Well, then we'll have staff do that, and the T-Guard will be notified, someone from the office will be.
And if you want Representative Norton to.
And if we're Representative Norton, she's still sitting on. And then we'll tell you. Okay. Then R37.
Mr. Chair, Section 14 in the Senate and Section 16 in the House are identical, except that the Senate in this location has, and the Minnesota GI Bill, we have it in another location. I would recommend accepting the Senate language.
There are three
out.
Is the expiration date included in that?
No, that's a different section. Yes.
Okay, so that's Section 7. Okay.
23.8 through 23.26 of the Senate.
Okay. Senator Pappas moves then the R37 language, 23.8 to 23.26. Any questions on that? If not, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. I can't believe it was so easy today. I'm just giving in on all of it.
Wait, I'm ready to give in on one now.
go ahead on R37 again on the advisory committee. Ms. Weidman or Ms. Lodak?
The difference there between the House and Senate is that the Senate specifies a date of 2009, whereas the House says that the advisory group does not expire.
Was this the office's?
This is the Office of Higher Education Student Advisory Group.
Mr. Chair?
You don't want to.
No, Mr. Chair, I just don't know if there's a reason why the Student Advisory Committee would be only extended for 2 years, unless, you know, maybe there was an old Senate policy that we only did things for 2 years. Is that it? Yeah, we had that policy for a while. But I'd be, you know, on behalf of the students, I'd be happy to move the House position on page 37, section, whatever it is.
Okay, you've heard the
Student Advisory
motion then on the 23.27, 23.29. Senator Pappas moves the House position. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. That's done. Now you're four up.
No. I moved the House position.
Yeah, but you moved it. Okay. Then on R40.
I'm not making another motion.
Shh.
No more motions.
R40.
On R40, the difference there is that the Senate codifies the reports on state grant projections where the House just has it as rider language. Other than that, it's basically the same, have the same dates.
Mr. Chair, could I ask staff to speak up a little bit with the rustling of papers and no PA system in here? It's kind of hard down on this far end to hear everything. Especially those soft-spoken ones.
On R40, the only difference between the Senate and the House is that the Senate codifies the language and the House just has it as rider language, but it's basically the same wording.
Thank you.
Was there a reason that we did it, Council?
Mr. Chair, it's been a tradition to have it as a rider, but after so many years, it may be time to put it in the statute.
Well then, Representative Welty moves the out of the Senate language.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm glad you recognize that we have great language.
Yes. Okay.
And style.
That's right. But this one does, you know, count. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. And finally, the R45. And who's going to take that? No matter.
R45, there is the change where the Senate repeals the 136A.1702 and the House does not. And this is the language that appears in 136A.1702 requires the Office of Higher Education to go to the Legislative Advisory Commission for approval for any activity in the self-loan program. And it was our understanding that this is something that they no longer do, so that that 136A.1702 can be repealed.
27.6 to 27.8.
The language is on the Senate side in 27.7.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, a decision on this, on these two provisions may have wider but not more serious implications. If you decide to go with the Senate language, then we are essentially accepting the Senate's repeal of 136A.1702.
Does the office want to come up and talk about that?
Mr. Chairman, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. This was language that was really put in law when the SELF program was started in 1987.
And the legislature has, in subsequent years, we've talked to you about issuing more bonds and all that sort of thing. And at one point, we did come back before the Legislative Advisory Committee when we were doing what we called SELF 2, changing the program a little bit, just because we wanted to make sure we were jumping through all the hoops. But it's been a long time since that we've been operating the program, and so language that says we have to go to the LAC before we sell bonds didn't seem appropriate any longer. It's up to the committee.
So it's in statute, but you're not doing it currently anyway.
We did do it at least once. We did it twice. We did it before we first sold bonds in 1987, and then we did it again about 10 or 12 years ago. But
When you did it that time,
people sort of
because you had been given more authority to issue more bonds? Or
no, it was because we had decided after talking with bond council and so forth that we wanted to change the program a little bit, and because the legislature hadn't been involved in that particular change, we went to the LAC for that. We do not intend to change the program in any major way without consulting the legislature. This is just, it's old language. In that case, we went to the LAC and they sort of said, why are you here? And we said, well, there's this language and we're trying to comply with it.
To either council or attorneys or whoever, is there any kind of problem you see about legislative oversight or anything on this? Or Mr. Fuller, maybe, been around for a while?
No, I don't really. I mean, I'm surprised that there was an obligation to do something and they didn't do it in bond council. I mean, they actually issued bonds because not in compliance with law. That's interesting. But, Housing Finance Agency doesn't go to the Legislative Advisory Council. I don't see what sort of expertise is there that, you know, they could avail themselves of.
Mr. Kanz, did you want to?
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to, make the comment, and Mr. Fuller said this, but we've not had any comment from bond council when we sold bonds that this was an issue, and they would have certainly raised it. So I'm not totally clear what the language says in that section of law, but I do know that it has not been a problem with bond council as we sold bonds.
Mr. Delman's informing me, he remembers, right, it also talks about the parameters of the program. Mr. Gelman?
Mr. Chairman, if I'm correct, then Kathy will inform me correctly very shortly, but it's not just when they go to sell bonds, it's any changes that they plan to make in the loan program also must be brought to the LAC, if I recall the language correctly.
And Mr. Nishkantz, I'm sure that you've come or whoever has come to talk to the House and Senate folks on the Higher Education Committee when you've ever done any of those changes, correct?
Mr. Chair, last year we spent quite a bit of time. In fact, I believe Representative Blatt was interested in many of the issues. So,
I think those were made. A lot of those changes were by rule.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, last year the agency brought forward language to increase the self-borrowing limits, for example, and those were done in statute. We also proposed some changes that had been in our rules. We were going to bring them into statute. Those changes didn't actually end up being in the language that passed at the end of the 2006 session. And we are actually proceeding through the rules process to make those changes happen now. And those changes were things like establishing a way for students to rehabilitate defaulted loans if they wanted to clean up their credit record, and some other technical changes like that. Another one was providing for temporary total disability for up to 3 years for people who had medical problems that might not be permanent and forever, but would be for a period of up to 3 years. The changes weren't controversial last time. It's just that the agency didn't get them passed in legislation, and rather than waiting for legislation to pass again, we decided to go through the rules process.
Senator Latz, do you have any concerns on this?
I had a few concerns about some of the changes that were proposed, not most of them, but we had some discussions, and the Office of Higher Education was good enough to meet with me at their initiative to let me know what their thoughts were. The rulemaking process is a public process as well, and I'm not sure that I would have been informed if they'd gone to the LAC either. It was really that the office just came to me. So I think maybe the better way to do it is when changes like this are proposed is to somehow, even whether it's going to be by rules or otherwise, is to notify these committees about the proposed changes so that we actually get to see some of it and not just being shunted off to the legislative advisory group. Those would be my thoughts.
Well, with the adoption of this, that's what we're going to happen is the rulemaking process. So, Mr. Fuller?
Mr. Chairman, maybe it would be wise to try to discern what the original motivation for the law was. If we spend the day, maybe I can find out, because it's not clear to me what is. Is it evident in the statute?
Ms. Novak?
Mr. Chair, there are three reasons that the office has to go get approval from the LAC. One is if they're going to implement a loan program. The second is if they're going to acquire student loans from other lenders. And the third is if they're going to provide programs of supplemental and additional loans. There's not much more to the law than that. This law was passed in 1983, but it was amended in 1995, so it's been looked at relatively recently.
Why don't we just sit on it then for the time being, and you can do it.
Or
if you don't mind. Okay, well, that brings us to that sheet. Senator, I don't see any final agenda here. Are there any other proposals on language at this time from members? Language differences, any amendments at the time? Let's have a little discussion on the Minsky
report. You know, yes, maybe we could look at it. Mr. Chairman, I was just looking through to see if there's something that we could get more information on. And on page R46, the interest rate swap. Looks like Mr. Misipanis is busy at the moment. Can they finish? We had a hearing on this, and we were convinced that it looked like it would be an okay thing to try. Maybe we could hear why the House is reluctant and what concerns you might have. Mr. Misikanis,
well,
on R46,
come up first,
the interest rate.
Talk about the difference in the language on page 46 between sections 33 and 40 on our side.
Mr. Chair and members, we had brought this language last year to the legislature, and it was, I think, in one of the bills, or actually both the bills, but in the end didn't make it through the conference committee. We've been working on this for about a year and a half. The summer before last, we met with three investment banking groups, RBC, Dane, and they are the investment group that deals with most of all of our bond sales now, Citibank, and I believe Morgan Stanley. They came in and talked to us about the idea of interest rate swaps and how it could save us money and reduce risk. We did some investigation at the time. It's a rather complicated approach, but we did do some investigation at the time. This is not an uncommon thing. In fact, the business is growing by leaps and bounds. University of Minnesota is engaged in these swaps in a dramatic way. Most of the private colleges do them as well. It's not a new deal. The Housing Finance Agency has the authority. I do not know whether they've implemented it or not or used it. We have been thinking about this for about a year and a half. The reason, and we've described this in front of the committees through the last 2 years, is that our sense is that we're kind of at a point where we need to test the waters. And we have said publicly that we would do this in a limited way, probably no more than up to $10 or $20 million, in order to learn, because we're at that point we have to actually do it to learn more about it. But we would act very cautiously in that process. We do deal, part of the House language does talk about contractual arrangements and things like that. We deal with our loans actually are, the bonds themselves trade every 28 or 35 days on an auction basis. And we've actually dealt with we try to expand the number of groups that do those auctions in order to reduce the interest rates. So we've kind of been doing that on part of this process already. We can bring that information in a more formal way back to you. It may be that a compromise situation would be to give us some limited authority and to move forward and think and to test the waters. But it's something that we've been working on for quite a while.
Senator Pappas, I think that was the concern that I had was maybe this time you launched and I kind of stayed on the landing pad or whatever. But especially when they're dealing with these kinds of money. So I don't know. Maybe it's another place where when the staff is working on another issue with fire education, they can look at this issue at the same time. Okay, and maybe some to think of something in that can meet our concerns about what the effects are going to be to those people sitting behind during their future, what happened, might happen with the loan program.
Oh, we understand.
Okay. Senator, any other proposals?
You said you want to talk about the Minsky Board?
Yeah, why don't we do that?
51.
Tell me where you're coming from, and I'll say where we're coming from. Actually, this was my initiative, so and I'm sure it was yours. So go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, two issues. One is I had heard the concerns from faculty in particular that the Minsky Board, the appointments on the Minsky Board were not very well balanced. There were a lot of people they're very good, and we confirmed them. And they were very good and very smart, and they spoke very well, but heavily with a business background. And we thought it would be important to have some people with more of a labor background also to be on the board. Our approach we took, though, is just to tell the governor that he had to consider to have a balanced board when he was considering his appointments. Make sure there's some labor people, there's some business people, and then we also were concerned about other diversity on the board. You know, it's also, I think it's been very heavily, male, I think. Isn't that the case, too? Where there aren't too many women on the board. Certainly when we think of, you know, how many women we have in our Minsky system, more than 50% are women that are students, and our faculty as well. And then the other issue with the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development currently has been appointed to the board, and I believe that's a conflict of interest. I don't think that the commissioner should be serving on the Minsky board. But in kind of in deference to Mr. McElroy, I proposed to have him seated as an ex officio member of the board, but not have a voting position. You know how much he likes to talk, I'm sure he'll be very influential even if he can't vote. That may, the House members may decide that maybe he shouldn't be on at all and encourage the Senate to just not confirm him, which is another option that we can do. But I'll give you an example where I think it's a conflict, is that members in the Senate may be reluctant to not confirm Mr. McElroy on the Board of Regents, the Minsky Board, because he's the deed commissioner, and we all, our cities, our counties, whatever, we want to work with deed, and we apply for grants from deed, and maybe legislators might not want to offend him by not confirming him on the Minsky board. So right there, I think it's a conflict that he's on both. So?
Well, let me tell you where I was coming from, and that is that, I've noticed that for quite a few number of years, and we tried to go back in time and see if there was anyone from labor on Minsky like there has been on the Board of Regents, or anybody actually involved in the system, like, whether it was teachers or professionals or
retired president.
I think there was one retired faculty member, and it was the one we found, and that was years ago. So I had a really great plan that I took a beating on.
I think I saw that language.
so I, honed it down to what I have here. And but I do like your geographic and gender balance. So, and as far as I'm concerned, I don't necessarily disagree with you.
Oh,
on the
Mr. Chairman, the other issue on geographic is the way the I mean, there's a requirement that so many board members have to come from each congressional district, but the way the congressional districts are drawn now is a lot of the northern ones reach down into the metro area, so that often isn't really even enough. And Senator Stump has come to me, and he wanted you know, to make sure there was representatives from the northern half of the congressional district, so that's why I put in the geographic.
We do have a member from Duluth, so I've been on there for a while, but I can understand that too. So, Madam Chair, do you want to make a motion on this and some kind of compromise position? And
well, I was kind of looking for things in the House we could adopt. What do other members think? You know, I think we should hear from our
input from other members.
Or maybe if I don't think Minsky will comment. Others might. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to, Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
Is there anyone in the audience that would like to comment on the Minsky board publicly?
Senator Pappas, you have to understand, when I'm chairing, you just do it. Here were the rules in my IRA and Workforce Committee. The only rules is there were no rules except I got to change the rules when I wanted to change the rules. So you go ahead and do what you want to do. Is there someone that would want to comment? Students, perhaps? You are. They do have representation. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself.
Stacia Smith with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And we feel it'd be best to not add the two union members to the Minsky board for two reasons. One is that the actual Minsky board has not addressed this issue yet, it hasn't been brought to the board or discussed at all. And the second thing is that Minsky is often asking for business input, and we think that the best way to get that is to have business members on the board.
Is the whole board right now is basically made up of business members, isn't it?
12 business members.
I don't. Mr. Chair, I don't know.
Ms. Cass, you don't know. Can you tell us who's there? And yeah.
Maybe we should get
them. Where's Minsky? Are they around here?
Maybe we should get the. We have that.
We're trying out now. Well, Senator Janicich, would you know the current makeup of the board by any chance, and how many business folks are on the board?
If he does it, we have a done.
Thank you, Senator.
I mean, I could be close, but I don't know the exact.
I would say an overwhelming majority are they not?
Yes.
Well, we just confirmed.
Well,
three.
Yeah, we have both Mr. Olson and is Mr. Weaver on there too, or Mr. Benson. So we have the head of the business partnership, which are the biggest businesses in the state, and then the head of the chamber, which are all the other businesses in the state. So I'd say pretty good representation already.
Mr. Chair, I think that's 2 out of 15 members, though. I'm not sure if I don't know the rest, but I don't. From what I've heard from David Olson, I don't think that he feels like there is a lot of business representation on the board. I'm sorry, I don't have the information about who else is on there, but.
Well, thank you. Very ample. Maybe we should have Mr. Olson come. I'd like to have him come.
Okay. You know, I think we're both, Mr. Chairman, I think we're both convinced that we need more labor people on the board. Well, I've looked at it, you've looked at it. You know, we don't need to convince the audience.
Senators and members, to me it was more not just talking about some type of union members or organized labor or anything dealing with that, although I thought the best way to do it was with this language, because I did have a list of other folks, including MAPE and others, that I was trying to address the fact that people that work in the system, that know the system, that know the ins and outs of the system, the rights and wrongs of the system, that work and are in the trenches, whether they're former members or current members, should be on the board. And that's why I had proposed it, because I think they're insight would be valuable to the board, and their suggestions and that would be, and you know, I mean, those are the folks that probably have their children going to the system also. So that was my intent with that. But is there anybody else on the committee, Representative Farland?
Yeah, I'm wondering, would people that work for Minsky have a conflict of interest, just like the
the commission?
The commission?
Well, I don't know if they would have...
Just a question.
I don't know if they have a conflict of interest. We can ask council if there would be anything. I know that in school boards, there are school board members who get elected to the school boards that are teachers in those systems. In several instances, I know on the range where school board members are also teachers in those systems. I can think of two different school boards right now off the top of my head that's the case. But I thought about it more about of a an issue of it being just valuable input for the board.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
You, on page R52, you also have a process for selecting the AFL-CIO members. Maybe... I'm just wondering if we could merge that process, I'm kind of talking out loud, with the
Don't feel bad. I do that all the time.
Well, I don't know if this will work or not. You can merge it with the, what's the group that does the Minsky screens them? Trustee Candidate Advisory Council process. But in the end, they get appointed by the governor. I suppose you're trying to avoid that.
Well, the governor, neither of the last two governors.
Oh, the governor must appoint two of the candidates to the Board of Trustees. So why not have the AFL-CIO recommend people to, instead of having them go through,
I do. They recommend, I think, four, or what is it?
I'm just wondering why we want to have a separate process for selection, and why don't we use the Minsky Trustee Advisory Committee process?
Ms. Novak wants to give us some information on this.
Mr. Chairman, the selection for the union memberships is parallel to the selection process that's used for the student memberships.
I knew I had some logic involved in this.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rome.
Now, you were mentioning that you were thinking of a variety of unions, and then you specifically list the AFL-CIO and give them both appointments. And I'm just kind of wondering why that would be. Why would you just have them? I mean, is everybody you want to include under the AFL-CIO?
Well, the overwhelming majority, but you are correct in that. You know, there are certain unions that don't belong. I think the Teamsters and the Carpenters and Laborers and was it the United Food and Commercial Workers? IBW that have left. SEIU that have left. But the reason why is I had some language in there to put MAPE on because of their involvement. There are a lot of MAPE members in the Minsky system. And then the Education Minnesota, and then I wanted a building trades because of all the different programs in the Minsky system, whether they're electrical, you know, electrician programs, or they've got their carpentry programs, their we have masonry programs, etc. But I just got pounded by my committee, and so this was my compromise language, and I thought it would be best for them. I'm assuming that out of those four candidates they suggest to the governor, they're going to be like Education Minnesota and some of the larger programs that are involved. You know, the IBW, as an example, has, I don't know if they came in front of your committee, Madam Chair, but they did attend one of our meetings. Of course, we had workforce development, too, in our committee, so we were dealing with the Department of Employment and Economic Development and DALI. So we had a lot of different issues, but I think for the IBW's Day on the Hill, it was, members, wasn't it? They came and it was an issue. They wanted to talk about unemployment compensation, but they also wanted to talk about the number of graduates in the electrical programs or electrician programs, whatever they're called, at Minsky, at the two-year institutions, and how they're oversupplying. And actually, I believe it was Mr. Steve Claypatch from the president of the Minneapolis local that made a very good presentation, actually, I thought. And so I thought some of those people should maybe be on that board and have some input, too. They would, you know, they're members of the AFL-CIO, and I thought with they could screen candidates and then present them, and the governor could pick the two that he thought were the best. So that was the logic behind it.
Well, Mr. Chair, you mentioned that there's quite a few groups that are served by municipal programs that wouldn't be represented by the AFL-CIO.
I think actually, Senator, the only one that I can think of that actually, well, maybe the Teamsters too, because there are those trucking programs, I believe, down here, a couple other places. But then the only other one would be the carpenters, the rest of them. I think all the building trades are still in the AFL-CIO. You know, the masonry programs, the electrical programs, the other ones. So.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if there isn't some way we could specify that that some members have to be from labor, but not specify which group, which labor groups would, you know, that these groups could recommend people to the advisory council or, you know, even recruit them. Because a lot of times that's part of the problem, that the advisory council needs to get the names of people to come through the process. And, I mean, they could come from all different backgrounds and then get screened. And then, you know, maybe we could ask the advisory council to make sure that they forward at least two people that have labor backgrounds. They wouldn't have to be from a specific union. But kind of to use the process that's in place, but to get the unions engaged in recruiting some people who they can encourage to apply.
Well, members, my feelings on this, at the very least, the that Education Minnesota should have some input into this, and that's one of the...
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, do you mean Ed Minnesota or the IFO?
Well, I think they're affiliated, aren't they? I don't know.
No.
They aren't they?
No, Education Minnesota is K-12.
Is the
IFO is...
And then the 2 years is the... What's the 2 year...
Minnesota Community College Faculty Association.
They are affiliated, aren't they? Yeah. I knew one of them. But yeah, the two-year teachers at the two-year institutions are affiliated with Education Minnesota. But I thought it should be more than teachers, too. But maybe we can all think of some language, Senator Pappas, that meets your concern about gender balance, too, and geographic balance, along with my concern on the labor issues. So I guess I'm glad we had the discussion, but we can move on, and maybe a way to move on to is go back to the GI bill, and I see we've got Senator Sharon.
I just want to support you in what you're saying about the IFO that presence on the board. It's not only the long envisioning that needs to happen, but what maintenance of the system and what needs to be there to support faculty and university administration wants to support the faculty to be successful in their mission. And I think that message gets there by allowing somebody from within assistance with it. The other is in the language when you're talking about the commissioner, you being, I don't know if you're going to incorporate that over into the House language, but I might suggest that if it was not specific to commissioner, indeed, if it was a commissioner in general, if you didn't have to label the specific commissioner, there may be another commissioner at a time. If you want to direct it towards a person who serves as a commissioner, would have this ex officio role, then it doesn't make any difference which commissioner. I don't know if that works, or there may be another commissioner at another time that gets recommended, then this is narrowed down to a specific.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, I mean, we don't have to do that at all. I mean, it really was just
a way to solve the problem with Commissioner McElroy. And you know, we could not confirm him, and that would solve the problem. But like I said, I don't know if the Senate is going to be willing to not do that. And it was, you know, I've been trying to convince them to just him to quit or become ex officio as a way of solving it.
And then Sharon.
I agree with the concern, the feeling that you have about what the consequence of a non-confirmation might be. So it demonstrates the reality of what you are concerned about. I'm being supportive of that, and I was just trying, rather than have it be so targeted and directly, if you just spoke to the issue of a commissioner, the language might speak to a commissioner being a person who serves as an official, just in general, but that would be a public policy position.
I think, and I'm going by memory, Senator, if I'm not mistaken, my initial bill had asked me, because remember there are, I'm sure, hundreds if not thousands of AFSCME employees that are secretaries and custodians and maintenance folks who I thought their input might be very valuable, and along with MAPE, because there are a lot of professional employees. In fact, I've been contacted by MAPE over the amendment that was put on in the House regarding the central office, because a lot of their, you know, lives are going to be affected by that. The only way you save $6 million at the central office is probably to lay people off, and I'm sure, you know, the first ones to get laid off are going to be the working folks. So I don't know how many janitors and that are there, but I'm sure the majority of folks there are MAPE. And then I thought about the two teaching unions, Senator Sharon, both the IFO and the two-year institution, which is affiliated with Education Minnesota. And then I wanted a person from the building trades, merely because of all the programs and the systems that are being taught on the different campuses throughout the state. But even my own members, I think, including a member or two on the committee over there, were pounding on me. I've been weakened a lot in this session, and so this was my fallback position on that. But maybe we could, you know,
Mr. Chairman,
go in.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to ask Mr. Janicek.
Janicek. An itch in yes. South Slav language means son of. So Janicek means son of John, for those of you. He's a Johnson, just another Johnson.
Just fade it off at the end.
Another Johnson with a different pronunciation.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pat.
Mr. Janicek.
But I don't see anyone else. Does Minskew, the chancellor or the board, have a labor advisory committee system-wide, or is that something more that happens at the campus level?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, that happens at the campus level. Right. That was a lot easier than the last one.
You're adjourned.
Great.
Wait, no. Senator Rowe.
Thank you, Senator
Rowe. No, it's just a concern I have. I really don't have a problem with having labor representation on the board, but I do have a bit of a problem having labor representation that is hired by Minskew on the board. I do see it as a conflict of interest. I don't have a problem, like you said, putting the construction trades people on that might be from labor who are out working in the field. I don't know, but it would seem to me that there would be a number of areas where they would have to excuse themselves from voting if they're actually benefiting from anything that they might be voting on. And it kind of takes away some of the reason for having them, but I mean, you wouldn't want to get into a conflict of interest situation, which I think could happen fairly often if you actually have Minskew employees on the board. To me, it's an uncomfortable situation. But I don't have a problem having members of labor on board and saying that we want some representation.
Well, Senator Roebling, the students that are on the board get the vote. They probably would have a similar conflict of interest. And I don't, with two members on a 17-member board, is it, with my addition, I don't think it's going to make, you know, any kind of a difference that they're going to be able to swing folks to, you know, have a bigger contract for themselves or something like that. But again, back to the, so I don't know if that's a concern, and maybe council can tell me where there's something in statute that would prohibit this. I have not had that brought up, and I don't think there is anything. Like I said, we in school boards that I know of, we have sitting teachers that sit on, and actually I know of a board where you have a bus driver, custodian, and a teacher that work in that school district sitting on the Board of Education. So, I mean, we do it all the time. Of course, they're elected to those positions, which is different, but the governor's appointing these folks, and the governor does have an option under this proposal that four are offered to him, and he gets to pick two of them. So if the governor thinks, after interviewing, which we found out he really didn't do anyway for the Board of Regents, that that somebody has a conflict of interest, he's got four to pick from.
Well, Mr. Chair, if he would only get four finalists that may all have conflicts of interest, he still has to pick two of them.
I can't see that happening. You know, these union thugs are very reasonable people. So I can't see that happening myself, but I'll see if I can come up and maybe Senator Oberlin, you can come up with some suggestions. Senator Sharon, I think you're seeing where I'm coming from on this, and so maybe we can have some input. And we've got a couple of up-and-coming brilliant attorneys on here too, with Senator Lance and Representative Atkins, that maybe can give us some advice on this issue. So.
Only up-and-coming brilliant?
Yeah. Well, they are brilliant, but
they're still working on them.
They're already brilliant.
I'm good with that.
Joe's up, I'm coming.
Yeah. So, the Veterans Affairs and Guard folks are here. Why don't we have them come up, and I don't know if you got the handout on the differences. Yes, you did. Welcome back. And maybe a little input on from you before we try to reach an agreement on that. We're just talking about language, of course, right now, so the money part of it isn't involved. There would be the dollar amounts that are in both bills. So go ahead, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel Eric Allness, Department of Military Affairs. The Department of Military Affairs supports the language of the Minnesota GI Bill with one caveat. That's in the Senate version that you have. And the caveat is that we don't feel that the tuition reimbursement program that's offered by the Minnesota National Guard should be figured into the equation as a first pay or subtraction program. And as you stated, I just want to highlight, although there are fiscal impacts on this decision, this is primarily a policy decision from our point of view. And the reason that we look at that is that the tuition reimbursement program is different from the other programs in that it's purely a pay-for-performance program. The other programs all provide funds to the student at the beginning of the month or semester to assist the student in meeting their obligations and facilitating their attendance. The tuition reimbursement program only pays at the end of the coursework and if the student earns a passing grade. If the student does not have adequate funds to pay for his education at the front end, they're responsible for obtaining a loan or funds from somewhere else. Further, the FAFSA application will not reflect this program due to its very different nature after rather than before, and also based on performance rather than on attendance. Secondly, the tuition reimbursement program provides the Minnesota National Guard a competitive advantage over the other reserve component services when recruiting service members into our ranks. If you look at Minnesota, there are seven different reserve component that it services in the state. We have the Army National Guard, the Air Force, or the Air National Guard, the Air Reserve, the Army Reserve, the Marine Corps Reserve, the Navy Reserve, and one other. I forgot it, of course. But there's one other one there, too. Of those seven, only two services, the Army National Guard and the Air Force Air National Guard, actually provide additional services beyond to the state beyond the other services. When the service member signs on to an agreement to serve their country, they raise their right hand and swear an oath to the Constitution of the United States. At the end of that, everyone else puts their hand down, but the Army National Guard and the Air National Guard keep their hands up, and they swear an additional oath to the Constitution of the State of Minnesota. And what that oath does is allows us to help in times of need, whether it be a natural disaster or domestic emergency. So the legislature, in their wisdom, have extended these additional benefits, and that's what we're looking for here, is really as a benefit to help encourage membership in your National Guard rather than these other reserve component services. Coincidentally, I think the day that this was heard on the Senate side, there was a big snowstorm, which we were called to duty to go down to I-90 and open up our armories in the southern part of the state and be prepared to go and help stranded travelers on the roads. And the third reason is that including the tuition reimbursement program, the first pay group, would virtually disqualify all the returning veterans from the 1st Brigade Combat Team that are currently serving over in Iraq. That's 2,600 men and women over there from using the Minnesota GI Bill. Because of the way that the pay is structured, if we included that, the first pay, by the time that you take all the subtractions out from the programs that the soldiers, service members would qualify for, they would not be eligible to access the Minnesota GI Bill program. So
Colonel,
I think
would that be for like a semester or a year or?
That'd be for the total time that they're applicable to apply for and use the Minnesota Tuition Reimbursement Program, which covers them for 144 credit hours, semester credit hours. So for the time that they apply for, if this was a subtracted program, typically they would not also be eligible to get for the Minnesota GI Bill.
So, Mr. Chair, can I ask for an explanation why, again, I don't understand?
You know, for a technical, I'd rather defer to higher ed to explain it because they know the formulas much better than I do. But if you look at the way it works, you get so much money that determines need to apply for a school. As you look at taking the different subtractions down, if you include our benefit for being a member of the Guard, the tuition reimbursement program, that take it down to such a level that there would no longer be a need, a demonstrated need based on the amount of money that the individuals already received, and they'd be ineligible to apply for the Minnesota GI Bill program until a time they're no longer eligible for our current programs.
So if they had taken advantage of that when they enlisted initially, and then gone overseas and come back, it would still be deducted under this language. And or if they had not taken it, come back and wanted to, what if they didn't take that until after they had gone to school and then under the GI Bill?
Mr. Chair, the Minnesota Tuition Reimbursement Program, it doesn't matter if they used it before or after. The difference is in the Senate language, it's included as a subtraction. So anyone intending to use it when they come back, it would become a subtraction to their financial need, and thus it would disqualify them from using the state program. Does that answer your question? Okay.
I'm curious because I remember when I was chairing State Government Finance, we kicked up the recruitment, the recruitment benefits and everything else. And is that part of what we're talking about here, or this is just the tuition?
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. Like I said, we look at primarily not as a college-age program, but as a recruiting and a retention program, and we appreciate the legislature's support of that in boosting it up to that 100% or to the full U of M tuition rate, so that way we can encourage people to join the Guard and be available to the state in those times of need.
And,
so,
and
in fact, that's what it does.
A good tool in recruiting.
Absolutely. Okay. We've been leading the country in recruiting for the last 10 years plus, and the last 3 or 4 years have just been incredibly, we're at the highest strength we've been since 1991 when we did a drawdown.
So, and then the language basically nullifies the way it negates the recruiting.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. What it does is it allows the other reserve components to use the state GI Bill program to equate what the benefits would be for us. And just to be clarified, not all reserve components, only if they deployed would they be able to get it. But it's an apparent as a relative benefit. So if we can clearly keep the Minnesota Guard in the lead and that the benefits provided to your Guard exceeds that of the other reserve components, that will allow us in all circumstances to make sure that we continue to attract quality force for you.
Colonel, what percentage of your members are deployed?
The Mr. Chair, the number deployed are about 3,000 out of a total of 13,000. And since 9/11, we've deployed almost the entire force, 12,600. So I'd have to do the math to see what the percent is, but 3,000 out of 13,000 is the number.
Any questions, Senator?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just wondering if maybe Mr. Fuller, one of the staff, could talk about what the subtracted benefits are. So what kind of benefits are these GIs already eligible for in terms of education? Do you have that? Anybody have that?
Yeah.
Thank you. Somewhere in the bill, I think. Right?
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I'm Tim Meadow from the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. I've been working with this bill. There are veterans who have served 2 years. There are veterans who served 3 years. There's guard people who have not been called up. There's guard people who have been called up for 90 days, there's guard people who have been called up for a year, and there's guard members who have been called up for more than 2 years. There's reserve force members who have been called up for 90, for 360, or for more than 2 years. And then there's also veterans who have no eligibility for federal GI benefits. All these veterans possibly are eligible for Pell and state grants. Very complicated to say who gets what. But a guard member is eligible to receive Montgomery GI Bill funds. If they have been activated, they are eligible to receive REAP, what are called REAP benefits, which are slightly better than the GI Bill benefits. They're eligible to receive federal tuition assistance benefits. Plus, they're eligible to receive, based on financial need, Pell or state grant funds. And then there's some other minor things like GI Bill kickers that I really haven't been able to follow.
Go ahead.
Looks like, Mr. Chairman, it's on the bottom of page 62, R62 of those bills.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilbon.
I guess I need a hypothetical case here to figure out what the value of all of these scholarships and aids might be. So in the end, if we don't exempt the enlistment incentive, would all of the tuition be covered for a number of veteran students? And then the 1,000, is that what you're saying? It's all going to be covered, so then they'd be ineligible to get it. So
not
then,
just for tuition.
Are we considering living
Chairman,
or miscellaneous?
I don't think we've limited it to tuition. It's for living expenses, too.
So I'm wondering then, are they getting enough to cover everything? And then this is on top of that? I'm puzzled. And that's why they wouldn't be eligible for it?
I will attempt to answer that, Senator. If my daughter, who is 21, had joined the Guard and was in Iraq right now, when she would come back, and she's attending Augsburg right now, she would be able to receive up to 120% of the state grant budget. She would receive REAP benefits of $2,900. She would receive federal tuition assistance of $2,250, total federal benefits of $5,153. She would also, because of federal legislation, be listed as an independent child with no income and no longer they would no longer use my wife's and mine income to determine her Pell and state grant eligibility, so she would go from zero Pell and state grant to around $4,100 Pell grant. She would have no unmet need and would not be eligible for the GI Bill, even if she got tuition, whether she got tuition reimbursement or not. Not every Guard member who National Guard tuition reimbursement would be eligible for the Minnesota GI Bill. Just financially. I don't think it would affect all that many people, but the policy, I got an update on what the policy was going to be in coordinating federal tuition assistance and Minnesota National Guard tuition reimbursement today. I'm still trying to figure out what the savings would be. But there's various programs. It's very difficult. If the same student was independent and had a spouse that was working, they may not get state grant and state or Pell grant, and then they would be eligible for the Minnesota GI Bill, except if you subtract the Guard tuition reimbursement, that individual would not be.
Okay, so I'm just trying to, Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to understand this. The cap is 120% of the cost of attendance.
Of the state grant budget.
So depending on what benefits you're eligible for, you could be below or above that cap. And if you're below that cap, then the Minnesota GI Bill would kick in for $1,000 year in our
semester.
Bill, whatever. Yes. But what the colonel was saying is that once we include the tuition reimbursement, that pushes many more people over the cap, so they wouldn't be eligible.
It would certainly ensure that most people returning from Iraq would not get the GI Bill.
Not get the GI.
I'm not sure that many of them would anyway, but.
Mr. Chair, for our graduates, they use the state grant definition for cost of attendance, which is a lesser of the cap that we have in the statutes or the actual tuition. And so for a graduate student, we have no cap in the statutes. So that could be quite significant if you're taking a graduate program at the University of Minnesota. So that's sort of a different universe now, because we've never included sort of a control on graduate school tuition in our state grant program. And since this refers to that, it would be the actual tuition. So it'd probably be more room to grow if I'm writing the graduates.
No, sir. The cost of education is 120% of the state grant budget, whether you're graduate or undergraduate. Mm.
Could you explain on the cost of attendance, two components, living and miscellaneous expense and tuition and fees? And then we refer to that, and tuition and fees are limited to the actual charges or the cap that's sent in law every 2 years for the 4 years and 2 years. We don't have a cap for the graduate school. So what would be the limit then on the graduate school tuition? How would it be the same as undergraduate?
The definition of a cost of attendance in the bill is for both undergraduate and graduate student has the meaning given in section 136A, 121, subdivision 6, multiplied by a factor of 1.2.
What are you looking at?
I'm sorry, Senator, that's on R59, subdivision 2, definitions C. Yeah, Senate side, it's line 38.25.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the assumption you're making is by referencing to that section, you're picking up whatever the limit is for a 2-year or 4-year school then for graduate school?
4-year.
For 4-year. Is that the explicit intention of this proposal? Because if it is, we might want to express that. If it isn't,
that's what I've been working on in all my financial projections. Yes, that was what we were going to use.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's unclear. And my assumption was the opposite. Since there was nothing there, it would be the actual, since it says one or the other, and we have the one, which is the actual tuition, that would be what would be used, because there is no limit in law for graduate school tuition. And I mean, whatever it is, you should probably specify so it's clear to those who are administering it and collecting benefits, so it's clear.
Even if, Mr. Chairman, even if a veteran decided to go to a private school, they're still limited by the 4-year cap in terms of financial aid, 120% of
yes,
that.
Senator. Yes.
So they could still have more expenses that weren't being covered.
Right.
Senator Lev.
Mr. Chair, do I understand correctly the Montgomery GI Bill, the REAP program?
Right.
And federal tuition assistance, those are not need-based benefits for veterans, is that right?
They are entitlements.
Entitlements.
I should point out for members of the National Guard who are complete their service in Iraq and get discharged when they come back, lose their REAP and Montgomery GI Bill benefits, as do all reservists. If they're not a drilling member of a reserve unit, they do not get chapter, I think it's 1606 or 1607.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, so if they lost those benefits, would that have the, would that impact their financial need or the other calculations for purposes of determining their eligibility and amounts for a Pell Grant and the state grant program?
For the Pell Grant and state grant programs, those are not counted as financial, what's the word I'm looking for?
Resource
there. They're counted towards the students' eligibility for loans, but not for Pell or state grant.
But it would also then affect, Mr. Chair, sir, it would also affect how close to that cap they came, would it not?
If they lost their GI Bill?
Yeah.
Well, then they would be eligible for the $1,000 a semester. I mean, they would have expenses, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lenz, if I may add in, though, I don't think one is a consequence of the bill to encourage people leaving service so that they could access the benefits. Again, we appreciate the legislature taking the action so members who honorably serve, but because of a deployment, they're not able to get the tuition reimbursement program. We've extended that beyond their term of enlistment. Just because the feds haven't done that, we don't want to unfairly encourage people to get out so they can take advantage of other state programs. And there is a number of actions going on at the federal level to change that law so people will be able to access those federal programs. But at this time, Mr. Med is correct that once you leave active or drilling guard or reserve status, you lose all the federal programs, reserve GI Bill.
Are there questions for Colonel Almas or Mr. Med? Senator Lass.
If I'm understanding this correctly, I mean, this is not a need-based program. So with limited dollars, whatever the dollar figure is, if there is a subtraction for other benefits that potential recipients are getting, then it would leave more dollars still available in the pot, if you will, to give benefits to those who would not otherwise have some of those resources available. Am I understanding that correctly?
Colonel Almas. Mr. Chair, Senator Lads, first of all, the tuition reimbursement is a benefit. The other things are entitlements that people have earned as an incident of their service, so I hate to put them in the same boat. The other thing is that our tuition reimbursement program, with a track record of execution and with the legislature providing adequate funds, that flow is working very well for us to be able to execute that program within the budget on a regular basis. So to gain savings from that isn't one of the objectives we need. Already it's working well within the allocated budgetary amount that we receive.
But, Mr. Chair, all dollars are fungible, and whatever label you attach to them, if you don't use them or for one purpose, they're available to be used for other purposes. And so if you don't use them for individuals that are getting the National Guard tuition reimbursement benefits, then they are available for others who would otherwise qualify for this program that might have more of a financial need for it, might not otherwise be able to afford school to cover their costs without this gap filler. Isn't that right?
It would certainly make some individuals not receive, certainly reduce the number of individuals that are financially eligible to receive money under this program, yes. You are right.
it would make money available to cover more individuals who might qualify. I mean, there's a cap. I mean, we're only going to cover as many individuals as there is money for. So if it's $10 million that the legislature appropriates and you bump up against $10 million, but you've got $15 million worth of eligible veterans applying for it, you've got $5 million worth of eligibility not being funded. And if we subtracted the National Guard tuition reimbursement benefits from some of those applicants, you might be able to fund some of the others that otherwise there simply wouldn't be enough money to fund. Isn't that right?
That's correct. It's Senator.
So obviously the state makes an appropriation to the Department of Military Affairs for this incentive program right now. Do you have any idea? Because I never see that breakdown. And how much is that is currently going into that fund from the state so that we can provide the incentive, which, as you said, is one of the best in the country?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, that's approximately $10 million on an annual basis for the tuition reimbursement and also for a bonus program. And also, there was legislation that would allow that bonus. It's primarily a bonus to encourage enlisted members to maintain membership through their 12th year. So it's a $10 million annual allocation.
You guys got back just in time. I was going to make a motion just to take the House language and get out of here. Oh, well.
And you have the votes.
I think so.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I mean, I think we've had a really good discussion on this, but because this is really tied up with how much money we're going to have, I think we need to not decide yet. We were close to kind of making a decision, but I think that would give us time to kind of talk to our members and see where we're at.
See, I have a question. I'm just curious, probably for the Veterans Department of Veterans Affairs. And I can't remember, when we gave, like, the first Gulf War, and we gave those bonuses and other bonuses we've given, did it require overseas deployment to get a bonus or not? I can't remember. Do you?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, your voice is
Mr. Chair, on behalf of Veterans Affairs.
Well, I will say, I'm surprised you're still in.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Mine started to go the other day, and everybody on the committee was hoping it would, but it didn't.
I was hoping mine would get better.
Go ahead.
Okay. According to my esteemed colleague, yes, it did require overseas service.
Okay. Any other questions on this particular issue then?
Mr. Chairman, I did have one that wasn't addressed, and that's the difference in the House and the Senate bill. Minnesota, let's see, I guess it's more liberal in the Senate. You have to be a Minnesota resident within 6 months of enlistment, and the House requires it at enlistment. I'm not sure I understand the difference.
Colonel, do you want to take that? Or?
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm not really sure, but you're right, the Senate would be a little bit more permissive, and it would allow, actually, it would be permissive, because it would allow people who maybe join the Guard and then move here or reenlist at a specific time, it would allow them, or any military service, I should say, and then take advantage of the benefit, rather than just at the specific time that they sign the document.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, so I see. So you could enlist, I don't get it. You could enlist and then move here 6 months later?
Yes.
You could.
In the National Guard. Well, this is all services.
Yeah,
right. That's right. That's
for
right.
Example, Pine City, the unit in Pine City, at least when I was familiar with it, had a number of Wisconsin residents. So a Wisconsin resident could join the Pine City unit, go to school at Mankato, and then would be eligible for this.
Once they go to school here, they stay here.
And specifically, that's why we added in the reenlistment, so it keeps people in Minnesota. So once they get here and start going to school, they don't move across the river and then continue to go to school here. It keeps them as a Minnesota resident.
You should have a requirement like that for a state employee. That's what it's not. Representative
Sure. Colonel, do you know how that compares to our neighboring states? Does Wisconsin have a similar, is it at enlistment or within 6 months? To the extension of
According to Veterans Affairs, they just have to be a citizen or a resident of the state of Wisconsin. It doesn't specify a different term.
So we're much more lenient then, as far as the way that we would treat people being eligible for this than at least our neighboring state to the. And how about South Dakota or North Dakota? You know,
there's, Mr. Chair, there's no program in either state.
I believe that there's a pretty healthy competition between Minnesota and Wisconsin for recruits, particularly in the Twin Cities area. And along, I assume that's true up and down the border, but wherever there's population, it doesn't take much to drive that 60 minutes to get to New Richmond or wherever they're based in Wisconsin. So to the extent it doesn't cost much to make it a little bit more permissive, it might be a good, healthy recruiting tool.
Colonel, does your, I can't remember, do the benefits that you offer our guards right now, those enlistment benefits and tuition benefits, do they have to go to a public, to a Minsky school or a public school?
Or Mr. Chair, no, they do not. They just have to go to an accredited program, so there's a wide variety of schools that they can attend to take advantage of those benefits.
All right, further questions? Okay. Senator, do you have any other language suggestions? If not,
well, my staff wanted to talk about that language about not using state funds in coaches. I asked them to look for language that was in the House bill that we could adopt, and that's what they told me.
Well,
I have the note. I can show you the note.
That was a floor amendment. My understanding is that the university had said to me early on when that whole, you know, the payoff issue came up that there were no state dollars used. And so when the amendment was offered on the floor, I didn't really resist it because the university told us there were no state dollars used in any of the buy-offs or the salary, whatever. So maybe is Ms. Peterson around here, or do you want to address that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Todd Iverson on behalf of the University of Minnesota. It's my understanding that there were no state dollars involved. It was a loan from central administration to the athletics department that the athletics department will pay back in full with interest over a 5-year period.
So, does the university have a problem with the language?
Mr. Chairman, I have not talked to the president directly or the administration on this. I will be happy to get back to the both committees as to our formal position, but I don't have that information at this point. If that's acceptable to the committee, I'd like to bring back a formal response.
I might point out that the language does, as I've been pointed out by my staff, that it does include the Minsky system too. So. Although I don't recall the Minsky system having any coaches that have had any huge buyouts.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I could ask.
Evidently. Of course, we've got some hockey coaches in there now. Then, Mr. Janicic.
Mr. Chairman and members, I believe that we are having a discussion in our office today that said that we may have a problem because of our employees being part of union contracts, and our coaches are part of some unions. I think they're IFO,
and that would mean we pay them with state dollars. And I think, and I would just as soon as I'll get this or somebody who knows this better, but I think when they leave.
Yeah, they probably have a severance package.
Yes.
Like a lot of teachers do.
Yes.
Senator Robin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know this isn't in the bill, but as long as Senator Mr. Jasich is there, I wonder, I don't know how many people read this article in the Tribune yesterday about the community colleges and mid-school system and the system they have for recruiting football players and their very, very dismal graduation rates. And I was quite taken back by this article, and I'm wondering if we're seeing a good use of public dollars being invested when it appears that students are coming really just to play football and to try and get an opportunity maybe to go to a Division II or I college, bring their grades up, which isn't happening. They're leaving the colleges and community colleges and groves without getting an education. Most of them aren't finishing their classes. You know, every year they say the turnover is huge. And Hibbing has addressed it. They're quitting their program for now. But it's really, I mean, I'm looking at the amount of aid that has been expended on it, like almost $4 million for players coming in to play football at these community colleges, and with about in some of the schools a 7% graduation rate.
Mr.
Well, Senator Roebling, I mean, you probably don't know this, but former Senator Jasich was quarterback on his team, and I think he made him play at Hibbing Community College. And look at how it advanced his.
Mr. Chair, times have apparently changed.
I will say this. I have not seen the article, but I got a call on it, and there are a lot of inaccuracies in that article, and I can tell you that the programs at Hibbing is certainly nothing to brag about. There are a lot of other programs, at least in the northern part of the state, that are. I could bring the athletic director from Ely down here, and he could tell you of the success stories and the number of students that have gone on to get a higher education, and in fact, I think are even in our MNSU system. You know, a lot of times, those news stories only tell half the story. So I don't think that Senator Jasich is that well versed in this. But
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't that good on the other ones either.
I do know this. When that happened in Hibbing, I certainly wasn't going to fall on a sword over it. It wasn't my school, but I was a little disappointed because I don't know what happened there. There was obviously a breakdown of, on the part of the adults and not kids. You don't bring kids that haven't been away from home to a place that's quite different from where they came from. And then just, you know, I know that Paul McDonald up in Ely mentors those kids and tells them right off the bat, here's the rules, here's what you're going to do, you're here to get an education first. And if I can help you by playing football get an education that you otherwise wouldn't get, I'm going to do that. And you're going to make your parents proud. And if you don't, you're out of here in the next couple of months. And there are a lot of good programs, but you don't see them in that report because that's not what, you know, sells newspapers. So maybe if it is a big concern of yours, we can have somebody come and discuss it further, but Senator Mr. Jasich, Representative Senator Citizen Jasich, do you have a comment further than that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we kind of anticipated that this might come up, and Mr. Lopez is here, and he could make some comments if he wants to, right? I mean,
Mr. Lopez.
I think, and if it takes care of the senator's concerns.
You know, while you're coming up, Senator, if we're bringing kids to play football and not to go to school, I agree with you 100%.
But in the case of at least the hibbing as a bad example, you know, I think it was adults that should be held responsible and not those kids who came here. And I don't think that typically happens. In fact, you know, the community of International Falls, it was also proposed that that program be just have it fall away. And the community rally, they said these kids bring cultural diversity to our community. They're good kids. I don't know what the graduation rate is or the GPA at the University of Minnesota's football team. Maybe Ms. Peterson could tell us that information. But, you know, I think that story, by the way, I was interviewed on that 3 months ago, I think it was. So whoever ended up doing it finally, it must have taken them quite a while to dig into things to finally get a story on the whole issue. I'm sorry, Mr. Logan. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Lopez, Associate Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs with the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. You're absolutely right with your comments, Mr. Chairman. There are occasionally problems at some institutions. As you said, the administration at Hibbing Community College felt that they had a problem. They dealt with a problem. We feel it's not a problem that is in terms of the academic performance of our athletes that is really as bad as some might portray it. And in fact, I don't think it's bad at all. We have looked at the cumulative grade point averages of our football athletes at state colleges with football programs from fiscal year 2003 to 2006 across all of our community colleges. For example, of students who entered in fall 2002, at the end of fiscal year 2003, they had a cumulative grade point average of 2.38. The following year, 2.30. The following year, fall 2004, for cumulative fiscal year 2005, 2.29. The following year, 2.29. So we feel that our football athletes are achieving at a rate that's certainly commensurate with academic success. We've also looked at the retention, graduation, and transfer rate within the state colleges and universities. As you may know, Mr. Chair, we compute what we call a success rate, and that is combining students who are retained, that is, who are still at the institution, who transfer to another institution, or who graduate. And I need to point out that certainly within our community colleges, we don't simply look at graduation rates, because many of our students come to our community colleges with no intention of graduating. They come for a year, for a semester, and then they have the full intention of transferring. If we look at just the colleges that have football programs, for all students in fall 2002, for all students, the success rate, that is, of students who entered the college in fall 2002, 3 years later, those students had a success rate of 60.2%. The football players at those colleges had a success rate of 57.6%. Not a significant difference. The following year, students who entered the following year at the all students at the community colleges, success rate of 60.3%. Football athletes, success rate of 50.9%. A little bit more of a decrease, but again, not a significant difference. And again, an indication that by and large, our football athletes are successful. They do come in, they do succeed with their programs, and they succeed with what their objectives are. And so we feel that when there is a program, we do count on our college presidents to address the situation, and it's something that we do expect them to do.
Any questions, Senator?
Well, I still have some questions about individual programs, but if their college presidents are willing to address the problems they face, as Hibbing did, I would be satisfied. I just want to make sure that where there's real problems, and it probably is not across the board, I never believed it was, but there are some real problems in some schools, and I hope to see those addressed.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, I can assure you that, if there are situations like that in the future, they will be addressed, and our presidents will be held accountable.
Representative Welty, do you want to tell us about your football career?
No. Mr. Chair, Mr. Lopez, just a clarification. Did you have an opportunity to read that article that Senator Roebling is talking about? And if you did, can you tell me if the reporter just used the graduation rates and did not actually use the transfer rates, which you discussed?
Mr. Chair and Representative Welty, I did not look very carefully at the what they were what the reporter reported. He may have looked only at graduation rates. And again, as I said earlier, we feel that for our community colleges, particularly, that's not an effective indicator of success.
And Mr. Chair, just to talk about that issue for just a second, I know in the Higher Education Committee and in discussions in the past that I've had with constituents, when they've contacted me about certain percentages that are being used, I think we've seen this done before where you talk about a graduation rate and people do not understand that that graduation rate does not include the transfers out of that institution to other institutions and the actual completion that's going to take effect. And so when we do talk about these issues, we have to be very clear what numbers we're using in these statistics, because you can use numbers that show that, you know, our institutions across the state are not doing a good job of graduating students when actually they are, because the students transfer out of a 2-year, go to a 4-year, and complete their degree. And that's my comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You know, I know when that whole issue was happening, Senator, it was disturbing to me too, but like I said, the more that I looked into it, the more it was, it seemed to be a story that they were trying to make happen. And like I said, I was talked to at least 2 months ago on that, maybe 2.5-3 months ago, and it must have taken a while to dig up as much as could be dug up. So, but again, like I said, you just can't bring somebody 2,000 miles away from home, an 18-year-old kid, and then set them down in that situation. That's pretty foreign to them. And not expect problems to occur if there's not adult supervision. So, I don't think we can't look at any more funding. Or look at any funding, I should say, because we still don't have any kind of ideas about our targets or anything else. So where did the senator go? Did she go with, well, maybe she's getting her one-time money. We'll maybe see if that's the case. Why don't we just take a 5-minute recess?
Things, but there's significantly different approaches, I guess, than there has been.
Really, I mean, what is But if they're coming to play football and get an education, that's not so bad.
Well, McDonald tells me you can get an education.
We're not proud of what happened by no means. But we are proud of what goes on in the okay, which is incredible.
End of the road. Isolated quarterback.
I ran for my life and threw when I had it.
I'm not throwing it all.
And we did it all with pretty much local kids. It was bad. It was. Yeah. I don't know that I went to the community college.
This
is our stuff for where we are, for that means to
not that the money will come out
both parts. I don't know.